Welcome to episode 106 of Your Kids Next Read podcast, in which we talk about books and reading for kids of all ages. I'm Alison Tate, author of middle grade adventure series, The Mapmaker Chronicles, The Atabán Cipher, The Maven and Reeve Mystery Series, and my new middle grade novel, The First Summer of Callie McGee, out later this year. I'm here with my co-host, the energetic Megan Daly, teacher librarian, also celebrity, at Children's Books Daily, and author of Raising Readers and Teacher Teacher. Megan and I, along with our good friend author Alison Rushby, are founders of the Your Kids Next Read community on Facebook. Search for Your Kids Next Read there to join us. So what is occurring in the hive of Megan this week?
Well, I've just been recovering from a little bit of a coughing fit because I made the other evening when I was avoiding housework, I made Marion's, as in the celebrity chef Marion, crispy chili oil, and it is divine. And I've been eating it on everything, including the silky mashed sweet potato I just ate, which does not deserve or need crispy chili oil, but it kind of improves everything. But then it kind of tickles the back of my throat. So if I cough throughout recording, that is why. I've been eating chili oil, and I really, really enjoyed yesterday's event. We both spoke at the Shoalhaven Teacher Librarian Conference, me on Zoom, you in person. And we talked about reaching reluctant readers from a parent perspective, from a teacher librarian perspective, and from our perspective as admins for the Your Kids Next Read Facebook group. It's such an important topic to talk about, isn't it, Al?
It certainly is. And it's definitely one of those topics that comes up, you know, all the time. Like, I think it's constantly on the minds of a lot of people out there. You know, how do we get our kids to read more? How do we get them to read at all? And there was certainly a lot of discussion there yesterday at the conference, which was great. It was such a great day. And you on Zoom, that was hilarious. Your enormous face behind me as we were having these conversations. It was kind of weird. It was like a podcast, but not. So it was kind of strange.
It was nice to have like a live podcast. And I'm so pleased that I was enormous next to you. It was lovely to have that moment. I think we were hoping that our takeaways from the keynote that we presented were that reaching all young people and nurturing them all as individual readers and meeting them where they're at is really important as both educators and parents and caregivers. I kind of spoke a little bit about seeking specialized support where there might be a literacy issue that is either diagnosed or diagnosable. I also talked about the challenges that face our readers in contemporary society, and that's very much things like the time pressures of fitting reading in around study, extracurricular pursuits, social gatherings, the call of the screen and social media, and the decline in parental involvement as children move from very structured primary school reading into high school. We also talked about how social media algorithms are quite precise and kids probably aren't going to see the bookish content we want them to see unless they curate that themselves. And we also talked about how kids tend to just have a lot less free time these days. So, you know, we talked about a lot of these issues and why there are so many reluctant readers. Al, you talked about that meeting place between reading and writing, which is one of the key messages of this podcast, the ideas of words in reading equaling words out. And you talked a little bit about that.
Yeah, look, it's one of those things that I obviously often visit schools and I'm doing author talks. And it's one of those conversations that I do have with the room because there will be kids there. There's always the back row with their arms folded. You know, we hate reading. There's the middle of the room who could go either way, but you know, whatever. And then there are my favorite people in the front row who are the keen beans who just want to hear everything I have to say. But when I talk to them about reading and why, because we've actually done a full podcast episode on, you know, why should I read? Because they do ask me that, like, why do I need to do this? Like, why can I be bothered? And I say to them, you know, that, you know, a 13-year education or, you know, 11 or 12, depending on, you know, when you leave school, requires millions of words, like millions of words. And I gave the example of, you know, I had a quick look back over some of the things that my, you know, Book Boy Junior, my 16-year-old, has had to do just in, you know, since school started this year, just in over the two terms, you know, short answers, long answers, essays, speeches, podcast scripts, emails, persuasive responses, creative responses, critical responsive, descriptive responses, like, and I could go on. And I talk about the fact that you know, words are your tools when it comes to actually, you know, getting to the end of this quest. It's like a quest. We're on an epic adventure here to get ourselves an education. And just as a builder wouldn't take on the building of a house without the proper materials, it's incredibly difficult to navigate the school journey without those tools. So reading brings students not just language, but insights, poetry, philosophy, humor, ideas. And so if getting through school is the mission, and, you know, for most of those kids in that room, it is like, it's just like, let's get this done. Then words are the tools, and the wider and deeper they read, the more words they have to bring to the quest. And when I talk about words in equals words out in those author talks, you know, I can see the penny drop for some of the kids in my audience. Usually that middle of the room sort of looks at me and goes, oh, okay, that makes perfect sense. And I know my job is done. If I see that kind of light go on in three or four little faces there, I know that my job is done there. And it's an important part of why you have authors in schools. It's that idea of, you know, we talk about reading and writing in a very particular way, and kids are often just inspired by the fact that books come from someone, you know, not just out of the ether, but from an actual person and their actual experiences. And no matter how fantastic the story is, there are always kernels of truth in them. And I think once they sort of start to get hold of that idea, it sort of feeds into their creative writing in quite different ways as well. We actually have I've distilled a lot of this stuff into our top 10 tips for reluctant readers. And I've put that in the newsletter archive for our paid subscribers. So our monthly newsletter is free always, with the, you know, big book mail giveaway, et cetera. And you can subscribe at yourkidsnextread.substack.com, but we also will have bonus posts and we have resources there for paid subscribers. And I'm sort of adding to those to kind of make it look more impressive because we've only just started with this. But that's, you know, I think the conversations and keeping that conversation going around reluctant reading is really important. I think it's important to not just treat reluctant readers as a homogenous whole, because I think that's, you know, part of the problem is this idea that I've got a reluctant reader. Well, no, you don't. You've actually got a very specific person there who may, you know, may not, for whatever reason, be coming to reading, you know, for pleasure in quite the way you might like them to. And I think that that's important too, to kind of like just always be remembering that, you know, people tend to think about this books for reluctant readers idea. And I talked about this yesterday as well, is the fact that when you think about the books from your childhood that really spoke to you and that you remember, they're the books that spoke to you, not necessarily to everyone or everyone who doesn't like reading or everyone, you know, whatever. They're the ones that spoke to you, and that's about the right book at the right time. And they're the ones that you remember. So I think it's about sort of, and you know, the key with it is always persistence, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I have actually been doing other things as well as talking about reluctant readers. I've read the typeset pages for The First Summer of Callie McGee, which is very, very exciting. I absolutely love the design. I've got these super cute little dinkuses in the scene breaks.
I've just discovered what a dinkus is.
Have you?
Because there's a dinkus in my book, the teacher book, and the editors were talking about what dinkus they will use, and I was thinking,
what's a dinkus?
I don't know what that is.
I think dinkuses are actually a font on your. I think you can actually choose dinkuses on your computer in Word. Word has a dinkus section. Very exciting. They're just a little picture or a little symbol that goes into denote a scene break. So there's been a passage of time, and the ones in my The First Summer of Callie McGee are a little pair of goggles. Very, very cute.
Because
it's all about a summer holiday. And of course, our other big news is that Your Kids Next Read turns, because here we are burying the lead again. Your Kids Next Read turns 6 this month. 6 years we've been, you know, prattling on about books. Two years on the podcast, but we founded the Facebook community 6 years ago. And we are celebrating with a survey. We're so cool, aren't we? In good news though, everyone who completes the survey has a chance to win a $100 Australian dollars voucher to buy books. So we'll put the link in the to the survey in the show notes at yourkidsnetsuite.com, along with all the T's and C's and the information that you'll need. We would love it if you would pop in there and fill out the survey. We're just basically looking to find out what you want more of. We're trying to work out how to make Your Kids Next Read even better. So we would love to hear your thoughts. We would love to know what you love about it. We would love to know what you'd like to see more of. So if you can fill out the survey for us, you have the opportunity to win a $100 voucher. It's super simple. It's about 12 questions because we know how busy everyone is. And as I said, you'll find it at yourkidsnextread.com. Or you will also find it in the Facebook group and also the current newsletter. And the survey is open from June the 1st until June the 15th. So we would love to hear from you.
If you have a child in their early years of school, you're no doubt feeling overwhelmed by uniforms, apps, and lunchboxes. But has anyone offered to help you with the reading? In her updated and expanded Reading Ready online masterclass, author and educator Megan Daly will show you the ins and outs of early literacy, demystifying those first few years of school reading and helping you to support your child in their reading journey. For just $15, the course includes a one-hour video, recommended reads list, exercises, and a downloadable guide. You'll leave feeling empowered and ready to take an active role in encouraging literacy development and fostering a lifelong love of reading. Get instant access now at childrensbooksdaily.com/shop.
Speaking of hearing from you, Megan, I would like to hear from you with regards to what turned up in your book mail this particular week.
Well, you'll be loving me because I'm finally doing a YA novel. I haven't done any YAs for quite some time. And I have got We Could Be Something by Will Kostakis, which I ordered a while ago. And I haven't actually received the copy I ordered, but I picked up a copy at Brisbane Writers Festival. It's a YA novel for readers aged 14 to 17. I will read you the blurb. Part coming out story, part falling in love story, part falling apart story. Mm-hmm. Harvey's dads are splitting up. It's been on the cards for a while, but it's still sudden. Woken by his father to catch a red eye, sudden. Now he is restarting his life in a new city, living above a cafe with the extended Greek family he barely knows. There's two voices to it. The second voice is Sotiris, is a rising star. At 17, he's already achieved his dream of publishing a novel. When his career falters, a cute, wisecracking bookseller named Jem upends his world. Their stories converge on the same street in Darlinghurst in this beautifully heartfelt novel about how our dreams shape us and what they cost us. Now, my first thought when I started reading We Could Be Something was that the novel had to be semi-autobiographical because, like his main characters, Will Kostakis was himself published at a very young age, and he is also wonderfully Greek and very connected to his year, who I've heard him speak about so many times over the years at author visits and the like, and also on his social media. It's a really beautiful exploration of intergenerational connections, and familial and romantic relationships are quite central themes in the novel. I feel like Will has really skillfully woven these themes together, showcasing the complexities and nuances of relationships. Greek culture is also integral to the story, and Kostakis's own Greek heritage shines through in his vivid portrayal of family dynamics, food, so a lot of beautiful food, cafe culture and traditions. I really enjoyed We Could Be Something. It's very much a heartfelt novel full of warm, witty and authentic characters exploring family, culture, love and identity. It's very moving, it's clever, it's super witty, as you'd expect from Will. It strikes the perfect balance between humour and emotional depth. It offers a really compelling and refreshing narrative that will resonate with readers from about 14. Plus, I've popped it next to my eldest daughter's bed. I think she's going to really enjoy this one. She's read all of Will's other books. And I enjoyed seeing him talk about it at Brisbane Writers Festival. If you get the opportunity to go and see Will talk about this book, definitely get yourself there. And then my second book is one for a much younger audience from about, I would say, 8+. It's Crash Landing Family Disasters. It's the first book in a new series by Nathan Luff and illustrated by Chris Kennett. I'll read you the blurb. A family holiday is a really, really bad idea. After a super embarrassing situation at school, Jacob decides the only way to escape the ridicule is to leave the country on a family holiday. But with a cheapskate worrywart for a dad and an obnoxiously loud optimist for a mum, fresh humiliation is around every corner. Even worse, the weirdest girl at school is coming along for the ride and won't let Jacob out of her sight. Jacob thinks he has hit rock bottom. Little does he know there is always further to fall in a family holiday disaster. I felt like this one would strike a chord with many, many young readers. It's funny. It's highly illustrated. Nathan Luff does funny well, but he also does. I feel like his books have got a lot more behind them. And in fact, I've got Bad Grammar as a YA novel in my giveaway pile at the moment, one of his YA books. And I just also think that whole idea of the family holiday and the things that can happen on family holidays is something that would really appeal to young readers.
What sort of age group do you think that one's for?
Definitely from about 8+.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've just got one this week because we talked so much up front. I thought I better save everybody from the ears. And this is a picture book. It's a very, very beautiful picture book called Mother Earth by Libby Haythorne, illustrated by Christina Booth. It's out on the 28th of June through Achette. And it's a new edition for poetry lovers. It's a gorgeous compilation of words and pictures. I'll read you the back. Let's dream of what we can become. Mother Earth, I am your son. Food and shelter, climate, water. Mother Earth, I am your daughter. A thoughtful and beautiful illustrated collection of nature poems to celebrate the wonder of our precious world. From beloved children's author Libby Haythorne and award-winning illustrator Christina Booth. So all of the poems are inspired by nature, and some actually have little notes in parentheses under them about what inspired them, like a row down the river or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. There's haiku on the end papers.
I love that one.
Add that in for you, Megan Daly. And I think, yeah, it's a lovely book, as you would expect from two award-winning creators. It's, amazing. And that was our book mail for this week.
From Shelley Ware and Serena Geddes comes We Are Matildas, an energetic picture book celebrating football and the team spirit of the CommBank Matildas, which will have you cheering from the sidelines. Find it at your local bookstore today.
Okay, moving on, Megan Daly, to our bingo question. And this week for our bingo, we again have the joy of spending 10 minutes with another fantastic author. Now, this week in the hot seat, and it is hot, let me tell you, is George Ivanov, a Melbourne author who's written more than 100 books for kids and teens, including the Interactive You Choose series, the RFDS Adventures, the Other World series, the Gamers Trilogy, and the Nonfiction Survival Guides, as well as he puts it, a ton of school readers and educational books. George's books and stories have been shortlisted for numerous awards, and as he says, he's even won a few of them. His latest novel, Monster Island, is out now, so we had a chat about that and various other subjects. Welcome to Your Kids Next Read podcast, George Ivanov.
Hello. Thank you.
It's very exciting to have you here.
Oh, it's kind of exciting to be here. I love doing podcasts.
You're not an easy person to pin down. You're here, you're there, you're school talks, you're writing books, you're a very, very busy individual.
Promotion time, especially when a new book comes out, tends to be really busy, and you're kind of like being pulled in so many different directions all at once.
Well, I have to say, having met you a couple of times and seen you, like obviously we've been friends on social media for quite some time. You're a little bit like Quicksilver anyway, I feel, even when you're not promoting. I feel like there's just a sort of element of that about you, which I very much enjoy and which I think comes across in your books as well. So let us talk about your new book, which is called Monster Island. What is it all about, George?
Okay, so it's about a kid named Bernie whose mother's a scientist, and she gets a new job, and it's a super secret job on a super secret research center on an island that doesn't actually exist. Oh. And he thinks this is all a little bit strange, so he decides the best thing to do is to follow her. So he stalls away on the boat and ends up on the island, which he discovers is full of dinosaurs and cryptids and other strange creatures.
Goodness me. That's a fairly uncomfortable spot to wake up, I would imagine.
Yes.
So it's described as, which I love, Jurassic Park meets Stranger Things. And I suspect it kind of came out of a meeting place of a lot of different things that you love. The only thing that seemed missing for me from the back was Doctor Who, which, of course, is a a huge love and passion of yours. But you tell me.
It is not missing.
Secret chat. It's not missing.
Yeah, there is a hidden Doctor Who reference in all of my books, except the educational books, because they won't let me put them in there. But all of my books have got an obscure, nerdy Doctor Who reference hidden away in them.
A Doctor Who Easter egg. And do you just take enormous pleasure in putting those in? Is that like one of the great joys of your life?
Yes, I do it purely for my own amusement. And it is like a real thrill when someone picks up on it, because these are hard to find. And I'm lucky in that at the moment my editor at Penguin Random House is also a Doctor Who fan. So it's the first time I've ever had, you know, an editor who picks up all my Doctor Who references when she's editing the book. So it's
like a secret handshake, isn't it? It's just your way of unearthing all the Doctor Who geeks in the world.
Indeed.
Right there. Now it's a fantastic action-packed story. So it's got monsters and it's got, you know, secrets and it's got drones and it's got all sorts of stuff going on in it. But it feels like an unusual middle grade book to me at the moment as well, in that the adults are very present. Like Bernie follows his mum to Monster Island. There are adult scientists all over the place. And it says something to me that I'm more surprised by the adult characters than I am by the monsters. I feel sort of like, and I guess, you know, you've got Bernie there and he's a kid in an adult world. How did you keep Bernie at the forefront of the story and driving the action when he's not the, you know, scientist or whatever?
Yeah, well, that was actually part of the thought process behind the book. I wanted to, because most of my books are, you know, just kids going off on their own. And actually, this time around, I wanted to plot the kids in the middle of all of this and all these grown-ups doing stuff. And I wanted to see how they would handle all of that. And, you know, the way they handle it is by doing things that they're not meant to be doing.
Of course.
So, you know,
it's the only way to handle it, right?
Yeah. So right from the word go, you know, Bernie is following his mum. He's, you know, stowing away aboard the boat, and he meets Ivy, the daughter of the guy who set up this research center. And, you know, because she doesn't get along with her dad, she's like all keen to help him. And so, you know, they sneak off and they do things they're not meant to do.
Which is all part of the fun.
It is. I love doing that. not that I love sneaking off and doing things that I'm not meant to do, but...
No, but the idea of it's fun, isn't it?
Yes.
And I really loved the marrying of science and myth in the book as well. And it's proved popular in the, recent times, in the Wednesday Week series by Christy Byrne and Dennis Knight. So I kind of feel like it's an important time in history to explore that relationship between myth and science. Was that part of why you wrote the book, or was it just more, this is really cool and I'm going to do this?
I think it's primarily because I like mixing genre elements when I write. And I've done that in the past. So I did a series of books called Other Worlds, and each one kind of fits into a different genre. So the first one was science fiction. The second one was fantasy. The next one was kind of more action adventure sci-fi, and then with the fourth one I kind of added a fantasy element, a science fiction element, and then a horror element on top of that. So I like doing this sort of this bit of a mix of genre elements, and I thought the concept that I came up with for Monster Island kind of allowed for that,
definitely,
and so I ran with it.
Was there a lot of research involved, in the sense that you've got, you know, extinct mythical creatures, you've also got science, you know, we're on a research station, we've got scientific stuff going on as well. It's hard to explain what I want to say, but were you constrained by it or set free by it?
Oh, set free by it. Always set free by it. I love doing research, and it's often the research that sparks the ideas. So Monster Island actually came out of my previous book, The Supernatural Survival Guide.
Oh, yeah.
And it's because I was researching the Bermuda Triangle for that book, and I discovered that there are actually other triangles out there, other bodies of water that are supposedly mysterious with mysterious occurrences. And we've got one, the Bass Strait Triangle, where there have been numerous UFO sightings, where ships have gone missing, where planes have gone missing. And all of it, by the way, is explainable if you look and dig deeply enough. But the fact that we had a, our very own mysterious triangle got me thinking. And I thought, oh, like I could put an unknown island in that triangle. And because I loved dinosaurs as a kid, it was like, oh, I could fill it with dinosaurs. But then I'd also done research about cryptids for the Supernatural Survival Guide as well. And so then I thought, oh, well, not just dinosaurs, I'll put cryptids on it as well. And, you know, it kind of snowballed from there.
How fantastic. Now, I've read your bio, George, because, you know, that's what researchers do. They read the bio. Excellent bios. You've got a couple, short and long, which is always helpful. But it also says there that you have written more than 100 books for kids, which is
Correct. Don't get too excited by that number, because that includes an awful lot of educational books. So things like school readers. And,
yeah, but even you still got to write them.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, if you're writing a school reader for prep graders, you know, it's barely 100 words. So.
I know, but you know what? I am rapidly coming to the conclusion, because I'm currently attempting, I've got a few things on the go, picture books and junior fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways, writing short stories, like short books for those younger readers, is incredibly challenging. Like, it's not an easy thing to do at all. It's hard to get a story into very few words. So I'm not going to allow you to just, you know, dismiss those readers, those highly important readers. What I want to know, though, is does it get easier as you go along? I'm asking for a friend here.
yes and no.
Yes,
in terms of school readers and stuff, because school readers are very prescriptive. You get a brief, and there are certain educational milestones that you've got to hit, and word lists that you've got to use. And certainly getting into the flow of hitting those educational requirements gets easier as you go along. But the actual writing, the actual coming up with the ideas and the plotting, that never gets easier.
Great. That's not really what my friend wanted to hear, George, just quietly.
I guess not.
Which of your books or series has been the most challenging to write, do you think?
I don't know that there is one that's more challenging than the other overall. I can tell you the two that I suppose were very challenging to begin with, simply because I was doing things that were a bit different, were the You Choose books.
Yes.
Because, you know, writing the first couple of those, I really didn't know what I was doing. And it was kind of like, you know, trying to work out how do you plot multiple branching plot lines. Mm-hmm. Once I got the hang of it, then you know, each time I came back to another one, I slotted in quite easily. The other one being the survival guides, because while I'd done lots of nonfiction before, this was the first time that I'd done kind of long form commercial nonfiction. So there was an enormous amount of research that went into those books. And probably with the first book, I had a little bit of trouble letting go of the research and getting on to the writing. It was like, oh, look, there's another rabbit hole to fall down to on the internet.
Research can be its own Bermuda Triangle, can't it? Like, really?
Indeed.
Writers have disappeared forever into research, forever. Yeah. Now, you're obviously a person with a great imagination. Were you, always like that? Like, as a kid, like, is that something that you, have you just always been creating your own worlds like that?
I was a daydreamer. I was that kid who sat in the corner of the classroom gazing out the window instead of paying attention during things like maths.
What do you think then, like for our, you know, listeners, what do you think are some of the keys or components of developing that imagination and creativity? Is it being allowed to sit and stare out the window?
Yeah, I think so. To a large extent, it's having nothing else to do.
Right.
I think everyone needs moments of nothing to do so that you can just sit down and think and go off on tangents and imagine stuff. And, you know, I used to do a lot. I still do a lot of that. You know, I'll be sitting on the train gazing out the window. I'll have a book in my hand, which I'd been reading, and then suddenly I'd stop and gaze out the window and I'd be thinking about all sorts of things and stuff. So, yeah, it's kind of like daydreaming time.
And do you think that's something that is harder to find now for kids?
I think so, because there's so much more competing for time these days. You know, back when I was in primary school, it was basically television and books.
Yeah.
That was what was competing for my time. And television was limited by the fact that it was not on demand. I had to wait until what I wanted to see was actually being broadcast.
Then run for the couch.
Yeah, yeah. Then bit by bit, things started to change and more things encroached on my time. So, you know, introduction of VCRs, which meant I could tape anything at any time, and then I'd have this pile of stuff I could watch.
Yep.
And then computer games. And to begin with, the computer games that were only, you know, at home on the Atari home system or at the bowling alley that had the game games. And that was it.
Yeah.
And then we got handheld games, and then we got mobile phones and the internet, and all of this stuff is just, you're constantly being bombarded by all these different things wanting your attention. So, as a grown up, I find myself being pulled in all these different directions quite often. And, you know, I may be a little bit obsessive in terms of playing Pokemon Go on my mobile phone. And occasionally I just have to, you know, stop myself. You know, I'm traveling somewhere and I've just spent the last half an hour catching Pokemon, and then I suddenly go, you know what? That's probably enough. I switch it off, and then I've got, you know, a little bit of time to do a bit of daydreaming. But it's
maybe
almost,
we should come up with a new workshop, George, where we lock kids in a room and we stand in front of them and we just look at them and they look at us until they get so bored that they start creating something.
Yeah,
it could work.
Possibly. The thing that strikes me, the big difference is, you know, when I was a kid with less competition, daydreaming just happened because there was nothing else to do. And now when I think about it, and you made me think about this, and that is the daydreaming I do now is kind of almost, I've got to stop and think about, oh, well, I could just sit here and do nothing. And
yeah, you have to diarize it now.
Yeah,
it's
almost like it's got to be fit into the schedule.
Yeah, you put that in as a priority. I am going to sit and do nothing for half an hour right here.
and sometimes I have trouble doing that because there's so many things I think need doing, and you know, totally apart from the writing stuff. You know, there's also, you know, family, and you know, I've got elderly parents and I've got children, and there's all these things pulling on your time. But
always. Well, speaking of workshops, and generally speaking, you don't lock kids in a room and
don't
do nothing.
No.
You're a very busy speaker in schools. What to you are the keys to a great author talk? Like, what are you aiming to do when you go out to do an author, you know, talk of some kind?
Well, you know, I endeavor to be entertaining. I try not to be a teacher. Because I'm not a teacher, so I don't go in there pretending that I am a teacher.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to tell kids, this is the way that things are done. This is the way that you write a story. I will say things like, well, this is the way I write a story. And I know other authors who do things in a completely different way. But here's why I do it this way.
Yeah.
So I guess I try to take a personal approach.
I always have to stand up the front of a room and say, this is how I write a story and this is why you should not do it this way. Teachers are sitting at the back as I say, well, I had this idea and I just dived in, and the next thing I knew I had 65,000 words, and they're all looking at me like, no, talk about planning.
And I do in talks also often talk about the things that are, you know, the things that I like doing apart from writing, the fact that I do play Pokemon Go and I like video games, the fact that, you know, I'm totally obsessed with Doctor Who and stuff like that, which quite often surprises kids.
Oh.
Yeah,
because you're a grown up and you like stuff that they would consider to be kid stuff.
Yeah. I remember one time after doing a presentation, there was a year six boy who stayed behind and approached me kind of tentatively and said, is it true you watch Doctor Who? You really, you know, watch Doctor Who? And I pull a sonic screwdriver out of my pocket and wave it at him and say, yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with it. And he goes, oh, yeah. And you actually play Pokemon Go. And I took out my mobile phone and showed him what level I was up on. And he was like, wow, that's more like a grown-up version of me.
And you thought, this too could be yours, kid.
That was really cool.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, George. I always enjoy our chats. And we're going to finish up today by, obviously, Monster Island is out now and it is terrific. But can you also recommend to our listeners another terrific book by an Australian author that you've read recently?
Sure. In fact, the book that my 14-year-old daughter and I just finished reading together, Three by Justin Darce. It's actually a few years old, came out in 2016, I think, from Ford Street Publishing. It's actually been sitting on my shelf for quite some time because, it, you know, to be 100% honest, the cover is not very appealing and it kind of put my daughter off wanting to read it. But once she'd read another book by Justin Darce, which had a great cover, and she realized this one was by Justin Darce, she said, oh, yes, let's read it. And so we read it together and we both absolutely loved it. It is such a thrilling book. I mean, it throws you straight into the action from the first sentence. Wow. But it's also a really thought-provoking story as well.
Sounds fantastic.
And it kind of straddles that middle ground and between middle grade and young adult. So upper middle grade, lower young adult.
Fantastic. And it just goes to show you the power of a cover, doesn't it? Like in the sense that there's this fantastic story hiding away behind that cover, and thank heavens you opened it up.
Yeah, because it is. It's such a superb book.
Fantastic. All right, George, where can people go to read both your short bio and your long bio and all of the other things about you?
Always go for the short bio. No one wants to read the long bio. Everything is available via my website, which is georgeivanoff.com.au. So my bio is there if you really want to look at it. Links to all my books, links to all my videos, because I do a lot of videos to promote my books as well. Anything you could possibly want to know about me is there.
There's even a video, I believe, on there currently of you getting your hair cut. Am I right?
No, just some photographs.
Oh, just the photographs.
Just the photos.
And you've just had your rather long hair cut off and you donated it. Is that correct?
That's correct. To the Cancer Council's program that collects hair to make wigs for people who are doing cancer treatments.
Fantastic. There you go. If you'd like to see George long-haired and short-haired, just like the short bio and the long bio. I'm loving the way my segues are coming together here.
Oh, that was brilliant.
I'd honestly give myself a pat on the back. Then you should go visit him at georgeivanoff.com.au. And thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
So, Megan, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did.
I love listening to George speak.
Oh, look, he's so interesting. And I think regular listeners will remember a few episodes ago, I can't exactly remember when, I was talking about the importance of daydreaming in creativity, of being bored in creativity. And of course, it was George that I was talking about, that I had interviewed on that subject. I think if anyone is an excellent role model and pinup boy for, you know, the ability to use your imagination, it would be him. So if he's talking about the importance of, you know, of that downtime, of that sitting around being bored for creativity, then I think we just need to all just get on board with that. Would you not agree?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. Now we're going to move on to our quick tips. And I have a quick tip for children's authors, because one thing I have received lately is a few emails saying, please do some more stuff for children's authors, Alison. So here I am. This one is for children's authors. I just wanted to say that I recently signed with a new speakers agency, Hello Speakers Inc. And while putting together my profile, I had a quick peruse through the profiles of other authors. where I discovered something that I should have been doing for years and have not. So this one is a tip for me as well. I've put together a PDF outline of all of the workshops and talks that I offer. It's an easy reference guide, which can be downloaded from the speaking page on my website or on my flash new Speakers Inc profile. I have no idea why I have not done this before, and I am very glad that I have done it now. So that's my tip. If you're doing talks and workshops, if you're out there, or hoping to get more sort of speaking work, put a little menu together. Who knew a menu, right? You can see mine at the aforementioned places. Tristan Banks has a great one. You'll find it on the Speakers Inc website, and Peter Canavas also has a great one. I would like to thank my fellow children's authors for reminding me to do something that I should have done a decade ago.
That's a fantastic quick tip, because it's really good as a teacher librarian or a classroom teacher to be able to see, you know, what you might actually be offering in a really, as you say, easy to have a little look at menu and kind of pick something out there, something to riff off, you know, when you're speaking to the author. Because, you know, sometimes we don't know when we go to, as a teacher librarian, when I go to somewhere like the Speakers Inc website and I'm sort of searching through who might be suitable, I want to be able to see what you are offering. So that is a fantastic quick tip. Thank you for that one.
Yes, Speakers Inc for reminding me.
And mine is also a bit of a reminder. Mine is my annual reminder on the podcast to start thinking about Book Week, whether you are a teacher librarian, a school, or a parent. If you are a parent, start pondering the costume situation and what you're going to do to enhance reading in your household next term. If you are a teacher librarian, I want you to start thinking about getting on board this term with some of the stuff that needs to get sorted, because once we hit term three, Book Week will be there before we know it. This year, the official Book Week is from Saturday the 19th of August to Friday the 25th of August. Children's Book Council of Australia Book Week. The CBCA has a fantastic website, as you would expect, where you can find all of the merchandise. There is also authorised promotional images on the CBCA website. I have just received my merchandise in the mail. Mrs. Malta and I are extremely happy with this year's merchandise. In fact, she cradled the acrylic seahorse that arrived the other day. It's got a beautiful, she did. It's got a beautiful neon green edge. And we both just, as we opened it, it was like this moment of luminescent light shone upon us, and we went, look, big horse.
You so, two you know, are such nerds. I just don't even know where to start.
So I highly recommend the Children's Book Council merchandise this year. And I also, for the first time ever, I don't know if it's the first time they've done it, I've purchased the CBCA reading journal that can be printed for the whole school. It's really fantastic. As well as what is on the Children's Book Council of Australia website, the Ipswich District Teacher Librarian Network, which I'm a part of, always does their fantastic CBCA Book Week publication. And it is finished. It's going to print. It's going to graphic design. It's available as a download from the Ipswich District Teacher Librarian Network website. And it is well worth getting that for all of the teacher librarians out there if you're doing Book Week in your library lessons next term. Something that I am doing next term is I am doing the CBCA shadow judging. I have just signed up for that and received my little welcome pack, and I'm going to be doing that with my year twos because we are looking at persuasive writing in year two, probably in preparation for NAPLAN. But we are looking at persuasive writing, so we're doing it through the lens of reviews, and I thought, what better way to do that than look at the CBCA shortlist and be a part of the shadow judging program. So we're doing that. And something that we are doing for our book week at the school that I work at, Mrs. Malta and I have been toying with the idea of book nooks and running some makerspace design thinking workshops at lunchtime. So start thinking about what you might do that's like your wow factor for Book Week. A lot of us have Book Week parades. We do have a Book Week dress-up day where we dress up as our favourite book character. We don't necessarily have the full-blown parade because we like to focus on the characters rather than the kind of parading. But we always like to do a makerspace type activity. And we're thinking book nooks, which is where you make a little nook with lights and little miniatures that will go inside a bookshelf, on the theme this year of read, grow, inspire. We're going to talk next week on the podcast about the design thinking process, and that'll probably get myself and maybe Mrs. Malta started on that whole design making process. So it's just your annual reminder to start thinking about quick. It honestly will be here before you know it.
Before you know it. I'm confirming author talks as we speak. Okay, I think we've come to the end of our podcast. What will you be up to this week?
Well, I'm going to make some more of my crispy chili oil because I am eating it at a remarkable.
This is something you might need to like take a step back from and just ration a little.
You obviously don't know me that well, Al. Like, I don't take a step back from anything. If I really like something, I go full into it, and then I will burn to the end of that. Burn my whole esophagus with the chili.
Almost at the end of my love affair with the Daryl Lee orange balls. # not sponsored. Because yeah. I just had so many of them. And I'm feeling like, so I've moved on a little bit. Do you want to hear what I've moved on to?
Yes, please.
Pascal's pineapple lumps.
Oh my goodness. Obsessed. I could move back to the Pascal pineapple lump. I love those so much. But I'm the same as you. I tend to burn through something and kind of overdo it. And then because I don't have any balance in my life and or emotional intelligence, my mother would say, and I do nothing in moderation. So I'm going to make more of my crispy chili oil. And speaking of no moderation, the beekeeper is completely obsessed with antiques or mantiques, as I call them. And his latest obsession is poker art, which is like vases and old bits of historical, I don't know, Australiana. He's collecting poker art vases at the moment. And apparently we're going on a bit of a drive to look at some local antique shops and discover some poker art, which I think is like art made with literally a poker from a fire.
Seriously?
Look, he's very...
I thought he was like bee related. I thought it was all bees
honey. It is bees and honey. He's extending out and...
Oh, branching in. You're going to have a house full of stuff. No. He's got a room set aside for his hoarding.
There will be no hoarding.
Okay. Well, what will I be doing? Well, one thing I'll be doing is I will be attempting to train Book Boy Junior because the school photos are on. And this year I would like a smile. I'm attempting to get a smile because he had braces for several years. And so we've got some very questionable faces pulled in the school photos. This year, I'm like, come on, like they look great, they're dazzling, they're straight, like I need a big cheesy grin. I want one like he used to give, you know, back in the day. But he's resisting my efforts to practice, so I'm not quite sure how we're going to go with that. I will also be compiling survey responses, obviously, and I have started a new Write a Book with Al challenge in my Write with Alison Tate online writing group, which helps to motivate me because I need to get a manuscript finished, as well as everyone else in the group. We sort of write a book together alongside each other in a kind of metaphorical online sort of way. If you'd like to join us, you can find details at alisontate.com/WWAT. But until we meet again, where will we find you, Megan?
You'll find me at childrensbooksdaily.com and on Facebook and Instagram at @childrensbooksdaily.
And you will find me at alisontate.com, alisontate.com. You will find me not very often on Twitter. I'm ready to give it up, I've got to tell you. But I'm there at the moment still, Al Tate, A-L-T-A-I-T, or on Facebook and Instagram at Alison Tate Writer. And we will look forward to talking to you again next time because we do feel like we're having a conversation with you and I hope that you feel like you're having a conversation with us even though we don't draw breath or allow you any space to actually tell me. It's pretty much what it's like in real life.
See you later.